It is Wednesday, March 23rd here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, our correspondent in Brussels tells us how residents have been responding to Tuesday's deadly bomb attacks in the Belgian capital. VOA's national security correspondent tells us why Western security officials are so concerned about more Islamic State militant attacks in Europe. And one of our Washington reporters talks to us about how webcams have made superstars out of eagles and pandas who happen to live in our city. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, the Belgian capital, Brussels, is coming to terms with a terror attack that killed at least 31 people at the city's airport and on a subway train on Tuesday. Residents on Wednesday took part in vigils and a rally in a sign of defiance. Our correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Brussels and gave me the latest information about the casualties from the attacks.
Local news is reporting that there is a new casualty toll that has the injuries up to 300 people. It's still they haven't found more deaths, but they also are reporting that 61 of the victims are still in intensive care of those that are injured.
And where have you been in Brussels today? What have you seen?
We've been walking around Brussels today. A lot of the action today has been centered around the stock exchange. Earlier, around noon, all over Brussels, there was a moment of silence where people observed it everywhere, and there were makeshift vigils set up all over the city. But around the stock exchange, the people never left. They spent the afternoon lighting candles, drawing on the sidewalks messages of hope and peace and love and sometimes anger and grief and fear. And also during the afternoon into the night, people have started singing and chanting, waving flags. You can see by the stock exchange flags from many different countries. There's a lot of foreign nationals and a lot of Belgian people of foreign descent here today to express their solidarity with the victims.
What kinds of chants or songs have they been singing?
Mostly what they've been talking about in the chants songs have been about solidarity, stick together, end terrorism. At some point there was a sort of rowdy chant just basically saying stop terrorism, stop the bombings. They've been in this city. It was about 4 months ago when the government here announced that there was an imminent threat against the city. And so even when the big news about this threat died down, when nothing actually happened 4 months ago, the people were still told by the government the threat still existed. So people have been walking on eggshells for months. So this attack, while horrifying, it's not something that was entirely surprising to everybody, and a lot of people are afraid that it's not the end, that it will continue.
Well, how much concern is there among the people in Brussels that there could be more attacks, and how is it affecting their daily life?
People are, for the most part, going about their daily life as per normal, partially because this threat has been going on for so long. There is a lot of concern that it will continue, if not in Brussels, in Europe in general. Increasingly, throughout the day, as details have emerged about the case, it's become more and more evident that it's quite likely that this attack was very much connected to the Paris attack, to the point where some of the attackers, some of the people that planned it, were the same people.
Well, thank you very much to our correspondent in Brussels, Heather Murdoch, for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
Intelligence officials say an Islamic State bomb maker whose DNA connected him to November's Paris attacks was one of the two suicide bombers at the Brussels airport. It's the strongest link yet between two Islamic State attacks that have stunned Europe with their power and planning. Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. I asked him earlier what his security sources are saying about what happened in Brussels.
It was a coordinated attack. It wasn't as coordinated and it wasn't as complex as the attacks on Paris, which involved more sites, more attackers. So you didn't have that level of coordination. But one thing that is clear, this is clearly off the same blueprint of the Paris attacks. And in the aftermath of those attacks, U.S. investigators and intelligence officials worldwide were warning, this is something that's likely going to happen again. This is a blueprint that will be used again by Islamic State. Because again, what one of the things that differentiates Islamic State from groups like Al-Qaeda is that they go after the soft targets. They don't go after the symbols, but they go after the easy targets, the soft targets where people are vulnerable and which by hitting them can strike fear across the population. That's been the Islamic State's MO. And again, no one is doubting right now their claims of responsibility.
Well, how much concern is there among your sources that we could see more of these kinds of attacks in Europe?
It's almost, for most intelligence officials, counterterrorism officials, a foregone conclusion that there will be more attacks. One of the things that they're saying is that this shows that Islamic State is involved in this, and they say what it shows is that Islamic State is deeply rooted. There's more and more weight being given to the idea that this isn't just a sleeper cell that was activated. This is part of a very concentrated, concerted effort by Islamic State to treat Europe as another battleground in its war to establish a self-declared caliphate.
And they have a network in that continent, apparently.
And especially in Belgium, in Molenbeek, there's concerns that this runs deep. But I've talked to several former officials who say, look, just because Belgium seems to be a weaker link, that they've had trouble going after these terrorist networks and breaking up these cells, just because of that doesn't mean that somebody else would have done better. They say it's likely what this is showing, what this and Paris is showing, is that there's a level of sophistication in the organization, that there's a very good chance the command and control for these operations, while there's a lot of leeway that these cells may have because they're sophisticated, it's coming from Islamic State core in Raqqa or Mosul or wherever they have their officials who are directing their external operations. And so it could happen anywhere. They're saying these guys are smart. They learn from operation to operation, which is another reason why investigators are so intent on finding out as much as they can about exactly how these Brussels attacks were carried out.
Well, thank you very much to our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden, for bringing us that report.
Anytime.
Well, up next, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with me in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, what are the trending hashtags today? What's the most interesting one for you?
So a pretty disconcerting hashtag is trending following the Brussels attacks, and I'm pretty sure you and many of our listeners will find it a bit disturbing too. It's hashtag Stop Islam, and that's attempting to associate the religion with terrorism. But the real reason why it's trending is because just as many people are using the hashtag to criticize the effort to link these two. There is a lively conversation going on underneath a CNN Facebook post describing the hashtag, and unfortunately, they are unfit to share on our show because some could fall under hate speech, but let's just say people have strong feelings about associating the religion with a recent string of attacks in Europe both ways.
Well, what are the U.S. presidential contenders saying about these Brussels attacks the next day?
They are talking about it still, and especially for the leading contenders in both parties, it's one of the main messages they're trying to get out on Twitter. Donald Trump wrote, "Just watched Hillary Clinton deliver a prepackaged speech on terror. She has been in office fighting terror for 20 years, and look where we are."
Right. Well, Trump is referring to part of her time in office. She was actually the nation's top diplomat as Secretary of State. So what did Hillary Clinton tweet?
She sent out several tweets about the incident and, of course, about Trump, but let's just read one. She wrote, "We face serious challenges in the world, but Americans will not turn on each other, turn on our allies, or turn away from our principles." And I believe she mentions that embracing diversity is widely considered as an American principle. Back to you, Michael.
Thanks so much, G. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, you can find her at G Abby Lee. That's spelled JEEABBEYLEE. And you can find me on Twitter as well. I am at Michael_Lippin. And please also send our show a tweet at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Nike's laceless athletic shoes with the awkward name Hyper Adapt 1.0. Nike says the new shoe is powered by an underfoot lacing mechanism. Think tiny motor that runs on a battery that needs charging every couple of weeks. When your heel hits a sensor in the bottom of the shoe, the laces tighten. You manually control the fit by pressing a plus or minus button on the top of the shoe. Nike claims the shoe will provide precise, consistent, personalized lockdown for the wearer, adding that the fit can be manually adjusted on the go. The new shoes won't be available until later this year, and the company says the HyperAdapt 1.0 will be sold only to members of the company's Nike Plus app service, which gets decidedly mixed reviews. Just Google it. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Rosans.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Well, turning to financial markets, Wall Street ended lower on Wednesday, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing down almost 0.5%. I asked our financial correspondent in New York, Jill Malandrino, what was behind Wednesday's losses.
What's behind it is that we saw a move 3% lower on crude oil, and that kind of makes sense because we're seeing the fundamental oversupply situation get further stretched. Iran has said that it's not going to cut production. Libya came out on Monday saying it's not going to cut production. So you have a move in oil where it essentially doubled from its lows, just a few points off of that, in a very short time. But it wasn't because fundamentals were improving. We're seeing massive, massive builds in crude oil. And another concerning thing is we're not seeing a drawdown in the refined product like gasoline. So that equates to an actual demand issue. The reason why we saw crude make such a run was it most likely was short covering more of that type of trade versus fundamental improvement in crude oil. And we're starting to see how that is playing out with crude being off so much today.
What are we expecting investors to focus on in the coming weeks?
Next week will most likely be slow, choppy trading like we saw this week. Around the Easter holiday, a number of European markets will be closed on Monday, and there's spring break and vacations and so forth. So it might be a little bit more slow. We also have another Fed meeting where I think it's going to be a very big focus to see if their comments are more hawkish rather than the real dovish, easy monetary policy that Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen spoke about in her last press conference. And we're seeing that this week. Four of the 17 Federal Reserve Committee members have publicly indicated their disagreement with the dovish guidance that Yellen gave last week. And that's what we call dissension, where they're just not all in agreement with having such easy money at this point.
And what does a hawkish view from these Federal Reserve members mean for interest rates?
Right. That's an excellent question. When you use the term hawkish, it means you'll see tighter monetary policy. They want an interest rate hike. When you use the term dovish, that's where you start seeing interest rate decreases, more easy money. What's happening now that we're in such an easy money environment, depositors aren't getting paid to have their money in the banks. The thesis behind easy money is credit becomes more available, the banks will lend more, and the consumer will put more money back into the system, and that will spur economic growth. That's not happening. So they have to do something to keep other market forces in check. And because this easy money hasn't been working, it's not spurring growth. That's one of the reasons why they might want to take up interest rate hikes.
Well, thank you very much to our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, for bringing us the latest from Wall Street.
Thank you very much.
Nature lovers have been flocking to the internet to see a pair of bald eagles that have taken up residence in Washington's National Arboretum Park. I spoke today to our correspondent here in Washington, Julie Tabo, who told me what all the fuss is about.
What's fascinating is that these cameras are stationed, one right above the nest and one nearby. And people like you and me can go there to our computers at home, and teachers in their classrooms can basically watch literally a bird's eye view of this nest. First, we watch the eggs hatch within a couple of days of each other, right in time for spring. And then we've been able to see the male and the female return to the nest, the mother primarily sitting on the nest to keep them warm, and the father going off fishing basically in the Anacostia River, which is nearby, and bringing the fish to the nest where the mother is feeding on them and also taking little bits of it almost immediately after the little eaglets hatched, feeding little bits of them to the little eaglets. So it's been fascinating for people to be able to see the interactions, the daily lives, and literally at night, too. There's an infrared camera, so we're able to see what's happening at nighttime, which isn't a whole lot, but to follow what we would never be able to normally see.
I just looked at this camera myself a short time ago, and I saw those two chicks in the nest. Very cute. But it's not the only popular webcam for animals in D.C., right? You, I understand, were just looking at another one today.
Exactly. I was totally inspired by watching the eagles and then the hatching of their baby chicks. And it made me think, what other webcams do we have in the area? So this was at the D.C. Arboretum, but there's also the National Zoo. The Smithsonian's National Zoo has their very wildly popular panda cam. And that captured the birth of the latest panda that was born last year. And that, because it was not open to the public, you know, they are not able to go in there and see the birth or even the weeks following the birth. And so everyone, visitors and all people from all over the world were able to watch the birth live on the webcam and follow the growth of the baby panda, the giant panda, as it developed over the weeks and months before it was unveiled to the public.
What kind of response have the Smithsonian and the D.C. Arboretum had to these webcams?
They've both been wildly popular. The National Eagle Foundation has basically said they've never had as much response as they had previously to an event like this. 9 million views as of last count. And the panda, the similar numbers. They've had millions of people. In fact, And both occasions, their website has crashed as a result of the interest. So what started for the National Zoo as a research tool, in other words, researchers were watching their every move to see how they can best serve the panda, the giant panda numbers that they have at the zoo. But right alongside the researchers, people like you and me can go and watch this and just learn what we want to learn about them.
Thanks so much to Julie Tabo, our correspondent, for telling us all about these popular animal cams in D.C.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And to follow the eagles, you can go to the website www.eagles.org/DC Eagle Cam. And for the panda, you can do a Google search for giant panda cam at Smithsonian's National Zoo. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Back in 2011, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope captured two red supergiant stars as they exploded into supernovae. Astronomers studying the Kepler data were able to not only watch both stars as they exploded, but for the first time spot the tremendous shockwave produced deep inside the smaller of the two as its core collapsed. Called KSN 2011A, the smaller supernova is only 700 million light years away from us and is nearly 300 times the size of our sun. The other, called KSN 2011D, is located 1.2 billion light years away and had 500 times the solar mass of the sun. The supernova shockwave is described as resembling a nuclear explosion on a massive scale. The astronomers say that their observations will help scientists better understand how the earliest moments of a star's explosive death is affected by its makeup and size. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Now for a look at the film world. A new sports drama looks at the life and career of British ski jumper and 1988 Olympian Eddie the Eagle Edwards. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the movie starring Hugh Jackman, Taron Egerton, and Christopher Walken tells the story of an unlikely hero.
Eddie Edwards had always dreamed of Olympic glory, but his body and his ambition didn't always agree.
Where do you think you're going, young man?
The Olympics.
You better take this. Put your medals in.
Thanks, Mum.
For as long as I can remember, it has been my ambition to become an Olympian.
Yeah. Eddie, you are not an athlete!
As a teenager, Eddie gave up his dream of competing in the Summer Olympics and took up skiing. Though he had some success, the British Olympic Committee rejected his application because he was not what they were looking for. Eddie decided to try ski jumping, a sport in which Britain had not competed in 6 decades. He completed the 15-meter hill, but injured himself on the 40-meter hill. That's when he meets an alcoholic snow groomer named Bronson Perry, played by Hugh Jackman. Perry is a former ski jumper from the United States who left the sport after a conflict with his mentor. He agrees to train Eddie, though his methods are unorthodox.
You want your moment, Eddie? You gotta do this for real. Our strategy will best be described as ugly but effective.
the Olympics is associated with certain qualities, excellence, achievement. They have no desire to associate with defeat.
You're a disgrace to the sport.
Good.
Personal best! And we're a disgrace!
In an attempt to keep Eddie out of the Olympics, the British Olympic Committee demands that he complete a 61-meter jump, something he has never done. Eddie continues to train, and during a practice for the final event of the season, he clears the distance, but he fails in the competition. However, Eddie gets a letter validating his practice jump as sufficient to meet the standard, and he is off to the 1988 Olympics in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. There, though he finishes last in every event he enters, Eddie becomes a worldwide hero for his persistence and tenacity. Taron Egerton, known for his role in Kingsman: The Secret Service, says the producers and cast wanted to create a movie that celebrated Eddie's achievement.
We always wanted to create something that was very affectionate and celebratory and, you know, championed him and reminded people that actually what he did was a really cool, amazing thing, you know. I certainly don't think that. I think he was a bit of a legend.
Director Dexter Fletcher says he has fond memories of the real Eddie Edwards.
You know, he was a bit of a character then, and you know, he played the clown, and I think we all felt he was a bit of a lovable klutz. But what was really interesting to me as reading the script was actually there's a much bigger story behind that. Anyone who gets to the Olympics, it's an amazing achievement by anyone's standard.
Eddie the Eagle Edwards says that Taron Egerton captured him pretty well.
Yeah, he studied me well because he pulled me off like, oh, it was fantastic. It was just like watching, and he looked like me as well. He had the moustache, the jaw, the glasses, the haircut, and I thought, oh my God, it's like looking in a mirror.
Eddie the Eagle is open in U.S. theaters. The film is rated PG-13 and is distributed by Lionsgate. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. My thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Carl Starling for working behind the scenes. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ancient spring festival of Nowruz is currently being celebrated by millions of people around the world, including Iranians, Kurds, Afghans, Azeris, Americans, and the peoples of Central Asia. Secretary of State John Kerry sent his best wishes to them all for a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. Nowruz, he said, is a time of renewal and reconciliation, a chance for families to celebrate their heritage and culture, reflect on the past 12 months, and look forward to the year ahead. In his Nowruz greeting, President Barack Obama again used the occasion to speak directly to the people of Iran.
Over the years, you've heard me say that the United States was prepared to engage with Iran in a spirit of mutual interest and mutual respect. Well, that's exactly what we did. In the last few years, our diplomats and nuclear scientists sat down together and negotiated face to face. And last summer, along with our international partners, we reached the historic deal on Iran's nuclear program.
President Obama noted that Iran has fulfilled key commitments under the deal, rolling back critical parts of its nuclear program and agreeing to verification measures to assure the world its nuclear program is and will remain peaceful. In return, the international community lifted certain sanctions on Iran.
Iran now has the opportunity to begin reintegrating itself with the global economy. That means more trade and investment, which will mean more jobs, including for young Iranians who dream of pursuing their careers and making their mark on the world.
President Obama stressed that the nuclear deal will not solve all the disputes between Iran and the United States. But even as our two governments continue to have serious disagreements, he said, the fact that we are now talking to each other on a regular basis for the first time in decades gives us an opportunity to solve other issues. In addressing the Iranian people, President Obama spoke of his historic trip this week to Cuba. My visit, he said, will be a reminder that, even after decades of mistrust, it is possible for old adversaries to start down a new path. As you and your families welcome the new spring this Nowruz, I hope that the friendship and ties between the American and Iranian people will continue to grow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.